Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am joined today once again by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Very good, thank you.
Just you and me today again.
Again, yeah.
Excellent. Well, you've written a very interesting column this week, which we're going to focus on. It's actually very relevant in the context of this week's lead feature, which is bargain shares. Simon Thompson's annual trawl of the market for shares that meet his Ben Graham based tests. And we're not going to talk about those. You can read those in the magazine, what Simon's actually come up with. But it's very interesting in the context of what you've written, because you've written about whether the stock picking techniques of some of the greats still work. Obviously, we're focusing on the great Warren Buffett. And he himself was once a Ben Graham inspired investor. So, Phil, let's kind of talk about your kind of thesis here. Being a Buffett, how easy is it for a private investor to do?
I mean, the short answer is not very easy, in my opinion.
I think you're right, but we'll come to why I think that.
And I think, you know, you look at, there are sort of three phases of, three different approaches of Warren Buffett investing from how I sort of view it.
Is it like the three ages of Elvis from Father Ted?
I'm not familiar with that work. But you have the sort of, you know, he started off as a, you know, a deep value investor.
Graham.
Yeah, he's Graham's most famous student. And for quite some time, you know, he set up his partnership in 1956, closed it down in 1969. Most of the gains that he made were coming from buying the sort of Graham-type stocks, which were the kind of stocks that were statistically very, very cheap relative to the numbers in the financial statements. There wasn't a lot of business analysis going on. It was essentially a statistical approach where the valuation of the shares compared to assets or earnings was so low that the chances of losing money was deemed to be low and the chances of making money was deemed to be better.
I mean, I quote your piece. Graham's philosophy was based first and foremost on not losing money.
Yeah, I mean, that came out of the, you know, the Great Depression, where and the Wall Street crash, and how investors lost huge amounts of money, and Graham lost a lot of money in during that time, and his approach spun out of that experience of this whole thing called, you know, the insisting on something called the margin of safety, a protective buffer, where you buy a stock where the odds are heavily in your favour, that if you get your judgment wrong about a company, your downside risk is very limited. If you get it right, and there's either through a catalyst or just through an improvement in the underlying business, the upside or the re-rating of the business upwards allows you to make a nice gain.
You say judgment. But you also mentioned that this was a very mechanical, statistics-driven process.
It was, and Graham used to own lots and lots of shares. It wasn't a concentrated bet. He would buy dozens, maybe hundreds, of shares that met this criteria, which tells you a lot of things about the markets at that time as well. You know, they weren't as extensively covered as by analysts and fund managers as they are now.
So lots of opportunities for serious mispricing.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, there's huge amounts of mispricing. Obviously, as this technique became successful, became more popular, essentially it got competed away because more and more people started copying it. And that was essentially the reason that Buffett gave for pretty much giving up this approach in 1969, because he said, look, I just can't find anything to make money. But before then, his thinking about investing had begun to change through the influences of Philip Fisher, who's written a, you know, a classic best-selling, Common Stocks, Uncommon Profits.
It's one of the first books I read, actually.
And it's a very, very good book, actually. Very good book.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of a tangent. The thing I loved about that was the whole scuttlebutt idea.
Yeah.
But you know, I think the word scuttlebutt is used quite loosely now to kind of, you know, invest about on the basis of what you see around you. But Philip Fisher's approach was very methodical. I mean, it was interrogating the supply chain.
that
going much. Well, it's basically what a hedge fund might do now.
Yeah, it's about knowing what you want to own and knowing what you own and getting, you know, a real grip on how a business actually works.
Mm.
And then insisting on, you know, various quality criteria of growth, the ability to grow, the predictability of growth, high levels of profitability, low levels of debt. Cash flow wasn't really discussed back then. So certainly profit margins, return on equity more than return on capital. Management, big feature on management about being honest, having a good strategy. And essentially, it was his influence, Philip Fisher's influence, and then Charlie Munger, who bought into this approach as well, which led to the sort of whole philosophy of, which can be summed up in the phrase that's been churned out hundreds of times, thousands of times, millions of times probably, it is better to buy a great company at a fair price than a fair company at a great price.
Indeed.
Because one of the big problems with the Ben Graham type of investing is that they cheap. If it works, they go from cheap to fairly valued, and then there's nothing more. Hence why they were called cigar butts. They were companies which had one last puff in them, like a cigar with one last puff.
So you can make a little bit of money quite quickly as the market recognises that the company's a bit better than it was previously thought.
Yeah.
But beyond that, there's nothing left.
Yeah, so then you have to go and find another one. Now, the difference with the quality approach, the Philip Fisher approach, is that these are companies that could keep on delivering. They grow. They could grow their sales. They could grow their profits. They could then reinvest. And this is where the whole sort of snowball effect or the compound interest effect, which is essentially the way that Buffett invests, comes into play. And first, that is done through the ownership of stocks. And then sort of from the late 60s, early 70s, of course you get the buying of Berkshire Hathaway, which was a textile company that was on its knees and was used as a shell. But then you get from the sort of early 70s, so you get two phases of Warren Buffett going forward from the early 70s is buying companies outright, so like the Washington Post, See's Candies was another one. And then you get the investment in high quality companies at decent prices. American Express is the one that's made him a lot of money over the years. And that was picked up when American Express got involved in some kind of scandal for selling salad oil. It was known as the salad oil scandal. And American Express's shares plummeted. And Buffett went and did the scuttlebutt. And he realised that people were still using American Express cards. And American Express ticked a lot of boxes in terms of profitability, predictability, simple, easy to understand. And he bought, and he holds that stock to this day. But if you look at Berkshire Hathaway now, yes, there are still investments in publicly quoted stocks. Apple, for one, is one that Berkshire have been buying recently, but essentially, Buffett's return now is coming from, or a large chunk of it is coming from the ownership of businesses outright, which is something that the vast majority of private investors cannot do.
Indeed. And you know, this is something that has always struck me about Warren Buffett's success, is that, and in fact, there was one acquisition in particular, which was an insurance company that he made very early on in this process, which gave him a lot of money to invest and to be able to buy companies outright.
Yeah.
And if you look at Berkshire Hathaway now, it's a lot of companies that he owns 100%.
Yeah. But see, the benefit of that, I mean, I'll give you a very simple example, which I sort of use. And this is why Buffett, I think you have to be slightly cautious when you look at Buffett's return in terms of book value per share, the progression. Is it the front page of the Berkshire Hathaway annual report? It shows the growth in Berkshire Hathaway book value per share against the S&P 500. And one of the great helps in any investing performance long term is how you perform in bear markets. Because in bear markets, by protecting the downside, you might underperform in bull markets, but because you don't lose as much in bear markets, your long-term track record tends to be better than most people's by protecting the downside. And by owning companies outright, Buffett protects the downside. I'll give you a very, hopefully, easy, simple example to demonstrate this. Let's say you buy a company on 10 times earnings. So if you buy that company outright, your return is 10%. If you just turn it around and get the earnings yield, that's 10%. So I get 10% return owning that business outright. If I buy a stock on a PE of 10 and the shares go down, I can have a significant negative return, which means that in a bear market, because a 10% return on investment is seen as decent enough to justify the carrying value of that share in the balance sheet, the net asset value, I'm outperforming, and I'm outperforming massively. But I underperform in a bull market when share prices are better than business results or grow faster than business results. And this is essentially not a criticism of Warren Buffett. It's actually the complete opposite. It shows that he has adopted to business ownership outright, and he gets the 100% business return rather than relying on the stock market, which means that his returns are less volatile and he can take a long-term patient view, which very few fund managers or professional investors have the temperament or the ability to do.
Private equity, Ken. You may argue?
I would argue against that, because I think that private equity gets a lot of its return on based on the price that it sells for, which is largely to the stock market. And I think that private equity returns are heavily determined by the exit price in terms of the internal rate of return, rather than sticking with a business forever and just compounding the improving business returns of that business.
It's interesting. You might conclude from that private equity may think about taking a more Buffett-like approach rather than the flipping approach that they take at the moment.
They can't, because they've got to pay their investors out.
Mm. And Buffett is his own investor.
Well, obviously he has shareholders, but you know, it's very clear when you buy a share in Berkshire Hathaway that you're not going to get paid a dividend.
Mm.
That the whole process is of taking the returns of a business and then reinvesting it, hopefully either within that existing business or finding a new business to buy.
So there are lots of books that try and teach people how to be like Buffett, and I guess what we're saying here is you can't. You can't.
You can to an extent, and I think, while some people will disagree with me, and we had this conversation before we came on air about net-nets and Graham, I think net-nets and Graham are very difficult to buy successfully.
So what I was going to say was, you know, you can't buy businesses outright.
Can't buy businesses.
Short of buying into Berkshire Hathaway, which I think is you can do.
Yeah, yeah.
So the two approaches that he has used throughout his career, the Graham approach, the Philip Fisher approach, can we still do that?
Fisher approach is that's the way that the private investor can go. And, you know, there are fund managers out there, Terry Smith, Nick Train, Keith Ashworth-Lord, who has a UK Buffettology fund, which tends to... That's what they're trying to do. And there's a section in the article where I sort of list a selection of shares that might fit that criteria. The problem is... And this is the other thing to add, just to go off on a tangent. There are two things from Graham that Buffett has always stuck to, and that is insisting on a margin of safety and also using the fluctuations of the stock market to his advantage. And that's what everyone can still do. Chapters 8 and 20 in The Intelligent Investor, by the way. Which I reread. Yeah. The problem I think for following this quality approach, and obviously this is hotly debated, particularly by those who follow this approach or who have to follow this approach. My view is that the price that people are being asked to pay for these kind of shares perhaps doesn't offer enough margin of safety. The valuation ratings on a lot of these highly profitable, predictable, excellent companies has been bid up very, very highly because of low interest rates.
So essentially, in exactly the same way that Buffett was forced out of the Graham approach because the market wised up to it,
yeah,
the quality Philip Fisher approach, the same thing has happened.
Indeed. And if you look at Buffett's behaviour over the last 12, 18 months, 2 years, he's not really spending money. The cash pile of Berkshire Hathaway is getting bigger and bigger. The last thing he really tried to get involved with buying was Unilever.
Well, they've had some results.
Indeed.
Today.
And since then, he's kept his hands in his pocket, which I think is, to me, is a kind of sign that valuations for these kind of stocks are a bit too high.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we could talk about a couple of them. You mentioned Unilever.
Yeah.
We've seen their results today. Not that great.
I quite like Unilever as a business.
Well, it's great. I mean, it's a quality business, but maybe we're asking too much of it.
But it's a big elephant. And, you know, it's very, very hard to move the dials on these big companies. And essentially, Unilever's strategy is a defensive one. It's Warren Buffett and his friends came along and bid for it. And they were going to adopt some very aggressive cost-based measures, zero-based budgeting or zero-cost budgeting, where you start at zero every year and you think very carefully how you spend money and you can enhance the profit margins that way. Unilever's taken that kind of strategy on. So the story is about turning Unilever into being even more profitable than it is already. And that is essentially being done by cost cutting, and they're trying to do it by growing sales. And it's the sales bit which has come out today, which is probably going to disappoint people. Then it's organic sales growth is they've set a target of 3 to 5% for the next 2-3 years, and it's going to be at the lower end of that range. And it just shows how tough it is for these big quality consumer giants to actually deliver meaningful quality growth, and that by that sales-based growth, not cost-cutting growth.
Mm.
You know, these companies, they're quite richly valued by the stock market because of their predictability, because they're selling stuff that people stick in their supermarket trolleys week after week, and they can churn out reliable profits. That's fine, but without growth, you start questioning the rationale. And I think,
did they say what's dragging on their growth? I mean, is it you know, substitution to the own brand stuff, which we've heard about for years, but they seem to have defied somehow?
I think they've got a very good portfolio, particularly things like beauty products, even things like, you know, the ice cream portfolio.
Oh, so Ben & Jerry's.
Yeah, Ben & Jerry's, yeah, Carte d'Or, Walls, Magnum, that yeah. kind of thing. It's pretty good. It's a kind of thing that there isn't a lot of substitution. It's not like, you know, substituting Nurofen that Reckitt Benckiser buy for supermarket own label for like a tenth of the price. So there is some defensiveness there. There is some, and also there's a very significant emerging market exposure there, and that's coming through in the results. Asia is very strong, and about 60% of the sales are emerging market, and only really Argentina, where there's hyperinflation, is the real problem with emerging markets. The problem is in developed markets in Europe and North America, it's very hard for the company to grow. Mm-hmm. And the fourth quarter has been pretty disappointing, particularly in the food and ice cream business. There hasn't been a lot of underlying growth there. And going forward, the underlying growth is going to be sort of towards the 3% rather than the 5%, which is not really much more than, you know, inflation.
Yeah. Should we look at the second company on the list of quality shares that you've presented in this feature, which is Diageo?
Yeah.
They've also had some numbers out today.
Yeah.
And you like those?
Yeah, I like Diageo. I think it's got a lot of robust characteristics, very difficult, you know, we had the discussion this morning about spirits and you know, you look at their brand portfolio. If you want to replicate premium scotch, you've got to lay it down for 12 years. You've got to have a lot of distribution. You've got to have a lot of marketing. And Diageo has built up an enviable portfolio of premium branded spirits. And obviously there's got the Guinness beer there as well. This is working very well. If you look at the underlying growth in this business, this is a business this morning that's come out and said it's growing at 7.5% organic.
Is that volumes or value?
It's about 3.5% volume, 4% price. So it's got some pricing power as well.
Yeah, both is good.
And the profits are going up, the margins are going up, the cash generation is good. And this business, you know, if you look at Diageo, it's clubbed into the same section of companies as Unilever is in terms of quality, dependability, pays a good dividend, got good cash flow. And at the moment, Diageo is delivering a lot more than Unilever is. And if you look at the way this business is being run, and you look at the, you know, you see the rationalisation of the drinks portfolio, this is then getting reinvested back into, you know, marketing spend is going up in this company. They're investing in marketing and it's coming, it's driving sales. There's probably still a bit more work to do here. It's driving margin and it's keeping the returns on investment and the profit margin. And profit margin in this business is incredibly high, over 30%. Getting close to 35%.
But I guess the question with quality shares, I mean, genuine quality shares like Diageo, who are still demonstrating those quality characteristics, is how much you're going to pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, Unilever is going to cost you about 20 times forward earnings. Diageo
seems punchy in light of the revenue growth.
Yeah, and Diageo is 22.
Which seems cheap compared to Unilever.
I don't know about cheap. But,
well,
but
more reasonable.
But, you know, if I look at, you know, if we sort of... Valuation's important. If we look at the underlying assets that we're buying or looking to buy, if you're an investor trying to play this theme, Diageo is definitely ticking a lot more boxes than Unilever. It seems to be in a sweet spot. And I wrote about Diageo in the magazine a few months ago, and the genuine bit of genuine sales momentum in this business, which seems to be building momentum and gaining almost a sort of feel of sustainability about it for the next few years, which Unilever's not. Unilever seems to be getting weaker from a sales point of view, whereas Diageo seems to be getting stronger.
Yeah.
And I just think that if you look at the markets that Diageo is in, they're all growing. You know, in terms of profitability, it's across the board. You know, there's a decent Asian exposure. The American market might still... That's a tough market.
Always has been. I mean, I covered this years ago, and America was always difficult.
Yeah.
Always difficult for Diageo.
But, you know, UK, I mean, if you look at where it's making its money, if you look at the things like the gin market in the UK, absolutely storming.
I mean, yeah, we talked about the sales growth there of Tanqueray.
Yeah, yeah.
Massive. And I guess on the basis of that, you can understand why Fevertree has done so well in this market. See, we won't talk about Fevertree because
we've done too much.
Very much so over the past few weeks.
But Diageo, if you're looking at dividend up by 5%, that's not you know, great level of dividend growth, but it's the dependability. If I was to sum this up, you look at Unilever and you look at Diageo this morning as an investor, and you look at why you own these kind of stocks. You own them for dependability, something you can tuck away, sleep quite nicely at night, you got a reasonable dividend and growth. If I'm an investor in Diageo, I'm probably going to sleep a little bit better than an investor in Unilever tonight. But I'm not going to lose any sleep, owning Unilever.
Yeah. I mean, just looking down the list, I mean, there's some very good companies on here, really fantastic companies.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some questions over some of the Fevertree is on there, for example.
Yeah.
We have some questions over that.
Yeah.
Howder Joinery, just spent a lot of money with them. Love the business. Yeah. Not sure about the UK cycle, but hey, what can you do? Domino's Pizza is on there. And yeah. I know you've written a bit for your Alpha report this week.
Yeah.
We've got some real concerns about this business. So yeah. It comes out as a quality stock on the screen, as it were.
It was the case study in my book.
Oh, yeah, of course it was.
It was the case study in my book of a quality business.
Yeah. Not looking quite as quality as it perhaps was when you wrote that, Bill. Oh,
definitely, yeah. Guilty as charged.
Talk us through what's happening here.
Bottom line is no one really is quite sure. But there's a lot of noise in the background, a lot of press articles about how Domino's is a franchise business. So it owns the master franchise to run Domino's Pizza in the UK, Ireland, and certain European countries. The UK is the dominant part of it. And it's reliant on people taking on a franchise and running a local pizza franchise under the Domino's name. And they buy their pizza ingredients from Domino's, and then they pay a percentage of their sales back to Domino's, and that's how Domino's makes money.
Which is what they call system sales.
Yeah, so the by far the biggest generator of profit for Domino's is not the franchise royalty. It's the selling of the pizza ingredients. The cheese, the bases, the tomatoes, the toppings. And from Domino's point of view, they want to sell as more. It doesn't matter how they go. If system sales, so the sales of all the pizzas of all the shops is going up, that's good. Because I'm selling more ingredients, I'm making more margin on that, and that's happy days. The franchisees probably see this a different way, because the way that Domino's is trying to go about selling more pizzas is by opening more stores in existing territories. It's something that's called splitting territories. And the best way to describe this is give you an example of a town which previously had two Domino's pizza shops, now has three. Now, in a growing town, growing population, that might work well. But in a town which perhaps has not got a growing population, that you are the argument here is that you are creating scope to really annoy your franchisees, because that third shop starts taking sales off the first shop and the second shop.
So what we do know is a lot of franchisees have more than one shop. So perhaps historically, you know, when they've tried to split the franchise, it's gone to somebody who is already
there's
the franchisee.
There's some very powerful franchisees out there.
And this is the problem.
Yeah. But you see, there's now a conflict of interest between the profitability of the master franchiser, Domino's UK, and the profitability of the franchisees. And Domino's gives a like-for-like sales figure for the last quarter of 2018 of 4.5% in the UK. But it's before the impact of splitting stores, which will reduce that like-for-like figure. So when it started splitting territories 18 months ago, it actually gave the effect of splitting. And obviously it's a reduction in like-for-like sales. And it stopped giving investors that information. So we don't really know as outsiders what's going on. And then there's another issue to throw into the mix. So we don't know what's going to happen to the profitability of the franchisees from splitting territories. The other thing, if you look at the Sunday Times, has been running a lot of stories over the last 6 to 9 months. And it's what it's saying is that these franchisees are getting a bit grumpy about how Domino's passes on the food inflation cost. So if the price of cheese goes up, Domino's franchisees get a higher bill. But if the price of cheese goes down, perhaps the question is Domino's keeping too much of that for itself?
I'll put only cheese reviews.
That kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. And the company is trying to talk this down, but it's clear that this is not just the only issue, because we've got this now cloudy picture of the core UK business. But then we have the European business, which was seen to be another leg of growth, is faltering or has faltered. Where they have a lot of they have franchises in they have the master franchises in Iceland.
Germany was the big one.
Germany, they got and then they've got Switzerland, and Norway is the other big one. And the Norwegian business has caused a lot of problem. And the like-for-like sales performance in places like Norway and Switzerland is not going very well. And the European business as a whole now is going to lose £3 or 4 million this year and probably break even next year. So this whole strategy of diversifying outside the UK, which was supposed to turbocharge the growth of the UK business, has come unstuck. And you're seeing that reflected in the share price.
Yeah, and I think we've got the shares on a sell, and we have for a while.
Yeah,
and it's been a good call.
It has,
actually.
It has been a good call.
I mean, I guess the lesson here is that, you know, something may pop out of a screen that says this business is quality, but you have to really do a lot of digging to assess that.
Yeah.
And you know, the same is true of Unilever and Diageo, which we've already
and also
through.
You know, things change.
Yeah. And quite quickly sometimes.
Yeah,
as well.
And this is the whole thing. You're not dealing with something that's set in stone. You know, you're dealing with moving parts.
I guess this is why, you know, you worry about the Ben Graham approach now, because it's often a balance sheet, in fact, very much a balance sheet-based approach. But as you rightly point out in your piece, balance sheets are a snapshot in time, and, you know, they can be a snapshot that's 6 months old and tell you nothing about what a business looks like today.
Yeah, I mean, for example, you can have companies, young companies that have raised lots of cash, and they're burning through that cash at a very rapid rate. So the last balance sheet, where the cash balance might be a large part of your net current asset value that Graham looked at, is a lot lower than it was.
And I think, you know, looking at your piece, I mean, if you do a pure Graham screen now, you don't get much out of it. Certainly not anything significant, not a substantial quality business. In fact, a lot of them are very, very small.
Yeah, I think it comes with risk.
Yeah.
And I think if you make your money, you're going to get compensated for that risk.
Having said all of this,
yes,
Simon Thompson's bargain share screen is a Graham-based approach.
Yeah.
Although you question whether it's a pure Graham-based approach. And it has done really well. And I can only explain that by suggesting that he does the screen and then does a lot more work on top of that, which I guess is what you have to do to make a Graham screen work today.
Yeah, I think, you know, Simon's not picking his shares just on the basis of numbers.
No, absolutely not. No, I mean,
which is something that I totally agree with. You should investing by numbers is, you know, quite a dangerous game.
I would entirely agree. I mean, it's something we've been talking about in the office a lot, and that's, you know, business analysis should almost come before any... In fact, it should absolutely become before anything else, before you even start looking at the numbers.
Yeah, you look at the businesses, and then you look for the numbers to try and confirm or reject what you think about the business.
Or what the business is telling you about itself, the story that a company is telling to the market.
I mean, the numbers, certain numbers, like profit margin or return, can give you an indication that you're looking at either a very good or very bad business. And then you have to then check whether that's right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, bargain shares. I mean, it's done well. I mean, it's incredible, actually. And I mean, Simon's been doing this for 20 years now. And the average one-year return of the bargain shares portfolio is 20.8%.
Buffett-esque.
Well, there you go. It doesn't work every year, of course. When, you know,
and but I'm nothing sure, does.
Nothing does. And, you know, where we have a bad year, we get dog's abuse for it.
Yeah.
But that's the market for you. But it, over time, and actually, you know, I think the thing you said about cigar butt investing, which is why perhaps Simon's approach is not pure cigar butt investing, is that actually if you go back to some of the years, you know, in fact, go back to a portfolio, say, you know, 5 years ago, they tend to keep going. They tend to be sort of, you know, genuine value.
Just to finally come back on this, is that there probably are certain bits of the cheap value investing that are more... I think asset investing via asset values is very hard.
Mm.
I think if you're going to invest by profits, or low valuations of profits, low PE ratios, which which I think is what Simon's doing.
Well, he does both, doesn't he? He looks at the asset backing, and then he looks at the other metrics that, that support that.
Yeah, and of course, if you're looking at things like profit, property companies, banks, financials, then obviously assets do come into it. I have some sympathy to the view that you can still pick low PE shares or depressed shares where there's a recovery and make money.
Yeah. Although, having said that, a lot of the shares Simon has picked, I wouldn't say they're recovery shares.
No.
They kind of look like depressed valuations.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't tell you them, but, you know, a house builder, for example, has had a torrid time over the last year for obvious reasons. There you go. Anyway, thank you, Phil. I mean, that's a fascinating discussion, actually. That's it. Investing cracks. We've got lots more in the magazine this week. The results are starting to ramp up a little bit. Sector focus this week looking at the wealth management industry. And Hargreaves Lansdown had some results as well. They're slightly different to a wealth manager, but there is some read across there. We have a feature from James Norrington looking at the latest updates from the US hedge fund industry, US asset management industry. Really useful stuff that we looked at a few months ago. We're going to do that regularly from now on to really get a view of some of the thinking behind the sort of biggest money managers on the other side of the pond. All the usual comments and news, including a big piece from Mr. Bearball on what's going on in China, which actually has some links to James Norrington's piece. Some really interesting news stories this week. Vodafone have had some results with some concerns around the dividend there. I know you don't like them, Phil. We have a slightly different view in the magazine, but there you go. The bidding war for RPC, which is hotting up, and the absolute disaster zone that is Flybe, we've taken another look at. Anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you, Phil, for some fantastic insights there. And we will be back again next week. In the meantime, bargain shares, get over to your newsagent, pick that up, £4.90. Simon Thompson's Hidden Value Picks for 2019. And hope they'll do as well this year as they have done in the past. Thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.